Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. And we've got a guest joining us today I think you're really going to enjoy. Saul Landau is an internationally known scholar, author, commentator, and filmmaker, best known for a wide range of work on foreign and domestic policy issues, Native American and South American cultures, and science and technology. Saul Landau has produced over 40 films on social, political, and historical issues, and he's won numerous human rights awards and awards for his accomplishments, including the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award, the George Polk Award for Investigative Reporting, the First Amendment Award, and an Edgar Allan Poe Award. Landau is also a political analyst and commentator for Pacifica Radio News, and he hosts Hot Talk, which is a series of interviews with prominent actors, filmmakers, journalists, and political activists. Joining us on the phone from his home, I assume, in Southern California, Saul Landau. Saul, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good to talk to you, Bob.
Well, I'm really delighted you could join us today. I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time. And I want to urge our listeners, if you're thinking, well, what am I going to ask Saul Landau about? I think it's fair to say that anything to do with national or international politics and media coverage is fair game for Saul Landau. And we're going to talk about a whole range of issues today. I'd like to start, if we could, Saul, with you just returned from Syria, is that right?
Yes.
And, you know, I think a lot of Americans hear the name Syria, but until we actually have a war with it, they won't know much about it. Could you tell, before you even tell us why you went to Syria and what you found, I mean, a little bit about Syria. What's the story with Syria?
Well, it's one of the countries that everybody thought could be next on the hit list of George Bush. And I got a chance to go there to make a little film, which is why I went, with my camera woman, and spent 8 days talking to people and traveling up to the Turkish border in the north and down to the Golan Heights, looking out over, well, no man's land, a minefield surrounded by barbed wire. And then beyond that, of course, there's an Israeli kibbutz with a big green field, and on top of that, there's an Israeli military outpost looking down and, of course, protecting it. And on the Syrian side, there was a destroyed city named Kunetra. The Syrians could have rebuilt it, I guess, but I think they're kind of leaving it there as a sort of museum, a city of 50,000, which the Syrians claim the Israelis dynamited and bulldozed. That is, every edifice is gone. It's just piles of rubble along, you know, sort of weed-grown streets. And it's kind of eerie, you know, you're like in a ghost town.
That's a pretty big ghost town, 50,000
people. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it goes on. And the Israelis claim that the town was destroyed in an artillery duel in the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War. But I asked, a high-level diplomatic source in Damascus. Naturally, of course, he couldn't be quoted, but he said the Israelis are full of crap,
mm-hmm.
that the Syrians had the story right, that they deliberately destroyed every single edifice before pulling out of the town.
And when was that? When did they pull out of the town? What year?
In 73.
73, okay. So what's the nature of the political scene in Syria today? Is it a country run by terrorists?
Well, hardly. It's a country run by the Ba'ath Party dictatorship. The Ba'ath Party is this pan-Arab nationalist, sort of semi-socialist entity which arose in some of the Arab nations. It arose in Iraq in its form, and of course it arose in Syria. At one point, they were together as part of the United Arab Republic with Egypt. Some people with memories might even recall that.
Mm-hmm.
But what's amazing about it is nobody wants to talk politics. You get Syrians in a room, and until you shut off that camera or tape recorder, they won't talk. And it's you know, compared to Iraq, it's relatively benign. And when I asked a Syrian government official, I said, "Let's talk about political prisoners." Her first remark was, "We have a tenth as many as Israel."
Is that true?
It's pretty much true. I checked with the Amnesty figures. And it's about that ratio. Of course, most of the political prisoners in Israel are Palestinian, almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in Syria, they're opponents of the Ba'ath regime, including communists. But what I found in Syria was an immensely diverse country. I met a Roman Catholic priest at the convent of Saint Serge in the town of Molula, maybe 30 miles north of Damascus. This Roman Catholic priest said the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, the language that Jesus spoke. There's very few villages left in the whole world in which that language is still used. Anyway, so then we went down and see, what's the town like where people speak Aramaic? And so we go into the barber shop, and we say, you guys speaking Aramaic? And they start speaking Aramaic. So the guy's getting his hair cut, right? And the camera woman, Sonia, says to me, God, he's quite a hunk. He looks just like Jesus. And in fact, he did. I mean, he looked like the poster model, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the Jesus that you see in churches all over the United States. And she says, I wonder what he's saying to the barber. And I said, it's probably something like, don't take too much off the top, because the girls like it full that way, you know. Anyway, here's a place of, you know, such historic importance, where we visited King Solomon's temple, 3000 B.C., Bob. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, in the United States, a house is 100 years old. We landmark it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can still see the artwork on the arches of the ceiling in the ruins of the temple from 3000 B.C. We're talking now 5,000 years old. Roman amphitheaters of 4,000 seats where you could still put on a play. This is in Basra on the Jordanian border, and so on. So it's a fantastic place if anybody wants to go and catch up with your own roots, that is, the cradle of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are Christians. There are Maronite Christians. There are Orthodox Christians, Roman Catholics. And, of course, then I met a Jewish antique merchant right outside of of Thomas's Gate in Damascus. That's where St. Thomas stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I lived in Brooklyn for a couple of years with my family there who had all migrated, but I didn't like it as much in Brooklyn, so I came back here. And I said, aren't you persecuted? He says, no. He says, nobody persecutes me. People are very friendly. They don't care that I'm Jewish. And I asked him, I said, are there enough Jews here to make a minyan? He says, oh, more than enough. He says, we hang out, you know, and we don't have any problems.
Hmm.
And I was amazed, because you get the feeling that a Jew in the Arab world today is, you know, is going to be a target.
Yeah, it's like being in the Third Reich or something.
Yeah. And the guy said, he says, if I want to go back to Brooklyn, I can go. If I want to move to Israel, he says, I can go as a Jew. He says, but I like it here. I do good business. I have good friends. You know, he says, I'm very comfortable here.
Now, what's the nature of the relationship between the Syrian government and the United States government?
Well, right now, there is a kind of, I think, thaw. That is, right after 9/11 and right after the Iraq thing, Syria was put on the list of rogue nations, on the list of nations that harbors terrorists. And one of the reasons for this is they have some of the Palestinian leaders of some of the old Marxist sects of the Palestinian leadership still living in Syria. I mean, these, by the way, these groups are hardly A, terrorists, and B, threats. And along with, I would say, the Syrians estimate about 1.5 million Palestinian refugees still living in Syria. So the Israelis essentially wanted them on the hit list. And I think, as most people are beginning to understand, the American government is often very obliging to Israeli government wishes. I wouldn't agree with the people in Syria and the people in Iraq, where I had been last year, who insist that Israel is running U.S. government policy. And I kept telling them, this is crazy. They have parallel policies, not identical policies. But the Syrians are now convinced, and I'm talking about friends of the United States, rich Syrians, upper-middle-class Syrians, who send their kids to Ivy League schools, who do their shopping in the United States, who adore the United States as a place to visit. These people are all now anti-American. And this is since the Iraq War.
I assume that they oppose the U.S. liberation of Iraq, or invasion of Iraq, however one wants to characterize
yes.
it.
Yes, I mean, I think it was universally despised in Syria, although Saddam Hussein was also universally despised,
mm-hmm.
I should be quick to add.
Mm-hmm.
There was no love for him. But the Syrians are all aware, you know, we think we get fairly good news. I watched the news there from Al Jazeera, and the news is much better. Certainly on the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So the Syrians are getting pictures of the war in Iraq that we never got here. That is, reality shots about, and the numbers of dead Iraqi civilians are, you know, they're really dramatic. The Christian Science Monitor calculated that as many as 10,000 died. Al Jazeera is reporting 7,800.
We're talking to Saul Landau today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Saul Landau has just returned from Syria, where he's been making a documentary. And right now we're talking about Iraq, Syria, and the Middle East. We'll be also soon talking about other matters. If you'd like to call in and ask a question of Saul Landau, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have lines open, and we have a caller. Let's go to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Saul Landau.
Hi. You were just talking about Syria and all the ancient roots of the Abrahamic religions in that part of the world, you know, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity being the three Abrahamic religions. But
right.
I'm wondering what you think of media coverage in terms of the kind of way that religion and ideology are becoming intertwined in the United States, and how religious feeling seems to be being harnessed or channeled into nationalist ideology. For example, I just read something on the internet by this guy, Victor Davis Hanson, because he was being discussed the other day by a Professor Lind here in town, who wrote a book countering his. But, I mean, he actually says that, you know, we need to get revenge, which I just don't think is a very smart thing to get.
Is this for the defeat of the Crusades or 9/11?
I'm not sure. I guess it has to do with 9/11, but it was an excuse for invading Iraq, which had nothing to do with it directly, and the people who were suffering were not necessarily in any way related. But anyway, so I'm just wondering about notions of justice and injustice that are being thrown around. I don't know if you're able to speak to these issues.
Well, I can speak broadly to them. I mean, I think there's a couple of themes going on. One is we have a very strange phenomenon in the world today where we have fundamentalist anti-Semitic Christians and neoconservative Jews in a weird kind of foreign policy alliance in support of Israel and broad imperial goals for the United States. Now, when I say they're an alliance, it's a kind of a marriage, but it's a sexless one between these anti-Semitic Christian fundamentalists and the neocon Jews. I say that, you know, in a sense that there's no sex in that marriage, but the rest of us get screwed.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. I mean, let me tell you a little story, because I think this is illustrative of it. Must be back 24 or so years ago, my wife's grandmother lived in a place, may she rest in peace, called Rising Star, Texas. I'm sure Bob knows exactly where it is.
I don't know if I was sober when I was through there.
Yeah, it's right near Blanket, in case you can't locate it on the map. Anyway, as we arrive in this really remote part of Texas, she is watching a Christian televangelist named James Roberson, who at the moment we arrive is saying that And God does not hear the prayer of Jews. And besides, you don't want to do business with those people. Well, I say, you know, well, to my wife, you and your grandma have lots to talk about. I think I'll check out the town, which took about 30 seconds. But anyway, at that night when we get back to Dallas, there's a rabbi in Fort Worth who has accused this reverend now of anti-Semitism, and the next day, Reverend Roberson calls a press conference to declare he is not an anti-Semite. And he takes from around his neck a chain with the Star of David, and holds it in front of the camera, and says, Menachem Begin gave me this Star of David. And the reporter says, why would he give you that? And he says, well, because we agree on a fundamental premise. What's that? And he says, well, we both agree all Jews should be in Israel.
Right, that's a bit like send the blacks back to Africa.
Isn't it? Well, then he went on to describe what an anti-Semite was when somebody asked him. He said, you know, an anti-Semite, that's somebody who hates Jews more than he's supposed to. Anyway, to take up on this theme, we have this weird, you know, right-wing fundamentalism in both Christianity and Judaism now that are pressing for what I think are wildly dangerous imperial goals. And what some of them are saying is that, well, Jerry Falwell just comes out and says it, that Muhammad was a terrorist. And, you know, that's really insulting, I think, to the people of Islam.
Right.
And you know, for I was describing the Jewish merchant, really, to show that a lot of Muslims can easily live in peace with people of other religions. I mean, these are not necessarily the people who are going to go out and stone their sisters to death if she gets knocked up by a guy she's not married to, as was reported in today's, I think, L.A. Times that happened in Turkey. But I think it's very, the point you raise, justice has been replaced, I would say, by retribution. And they're different concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very serious one, where you look now at U.S. foreign policy, and assassination has oozed its way into the policy now as an instrument that is used without question. I mean, when you stop and think about it, one government decides to murder another individual without recourse to courts of law. And that now becomes an instrument of U.S. policy. The policy now is to assassinate Saddam Hussein, as it was before the war. As we know in the past, the CIA was involved in this, and then Senator Church held hearings back in the mid-1970s to say this is a very bad idea, because if we set this policy up, other people can do it on us and claim, well, this is our policy, so why shouldn't it be theirs? But I think, you see, to go again back to your question, is that the makers of policy in the U.S. government, the Christian ones, have memorized only the first three words of that important Christian adage, which goes, do unto others.
Right. Well, I mean, I just think, as Professor Lynn was talking about, this kind of crusader mentality that some, you know, ideologues for the military are coming up with, that it's not a logical, safe, rational, it's not the best way of doing business, aside the fact that we're a multicultural society. And the same with, you know, taking revenge. This isn't going to make us safer. We have to have strategies that make us safer, not just act on, you know, pure animal emotion.
Well, you can put it a different way. You can say that on 9/11, after the horrible events occurred, almost the entire world, and I'm talking about Fidel Castro in Cuba, and the Chinese and Japanese, and from all over the world, people were pouring their sympathies onto the United States and offering help, goodwill, whatever. The United States never enjoyed such prestige and adoration from the rest of the world, probably since the end of World War II. And the great accomplishment, and this is, you know, you can't take this away from him, in less than 2 years, George W. Bush has totally turned that around and made us the most hated of any time in our history, including during the height of the Vietnam War. And that's quite an accomplishment, you have to admit.
Yes, we're talking to Saul Landau today on Media Matters. Landau is the internationally known scholar, author, commentator, and filmmaker. He has just returned from Syria, and we're talking about the Iraq War in the Middle East now. Later, we'll be talking about Latin America, Cuba, and media right here in the United States. If you'd like to call in and have a question for Saul Landau, the number is 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Saul, one question I have, if you know, you've been in the Middle East, you were saying you've watched Al Jazeera, you've seen the press coverage outside of the United States of the war in Iraq. What would you say, if you could say there are two or three things that the news coverage in the United States has basically dropped the ball on or missed, then what are the big things that most Americans simply aren't being exposed to that they might be exposed to if they were living somewhere else in the world?
Well, I think the first thing is the totally unequal nature of the fight. You know, it's as if, just like during or before the Gulf War number one, the White House had hired Don King, the boxing promoter, to come in and get Saddam Hussein accepted as a ranking heavyweight contender. I mean, he was an 85th ranked flyweight who was promoted as a ranking heavyweight. And then the United States went in, and we beat him up good. And now Saddam Hussein, who has deeply reduced even from his 85th ranking flyweight condition, is again promoted as, well, he has weapons of mass destruction and so on. So the United States promoted a war that the rest of the world really saw as beyond unnecessary, certainly unwarranted. And I think everybody else is beginning to ask, what the hell was the casus belli again? You know, the reasons for going to war. Maureen Dowd, I thought, had it, put it well. She said they've replaced casus belli with casuistry belli. And I thought that was a very appropriate. Mm-hmm. That is, if you go back, Bob, to the Nuremberg trials, it's really important to look at the basis for those prosecutions. Justice Robert L. Jackson, who was at that time a Supreme Court justice, says to the Germans, look, we want you to understand that we're not prosecuting German civilian and military officials because you lost the war. We're prosecuting you because you started the war. And from now on, there can't be any more unjust wars. That is, wars that have no reason without provocation. In other words, like the one that George W. Bush just fought in Iraq. Now, I think the rest of the world is on to this, that they understand this. The American public, is, you know, I think it's typified by a colleague of mine, a Republican. He says, all right, I admit, there probably isn't any nuclear program there, and there probably isn't any sign of any chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction. And all right, I'll concede that there's no links to Al-Qaeda or Bin Laden or any of those fiends. But aren't you glad we got rid of them anyway? Now, that may be, you know, if you're going to the movies, that's what you see. You know, there's in the Hollywood scenario, the bad guy is supposed to get killed violently. That's the grammar of the industry. But when you translate that into foreign policy or, you know, create a crude kind of what Tom Powers in the New York Times say calls frontier justice as foreign policy, the rest of the world responds very apprehensively. And I think this is what's happened. People are scared of the United States now because, you know, the sheriff's unpredictable. I remember, you know, if you watch those old odors, O-A-T-E-R-S, like Gunsmoke, right? And you wanted to do a takeoff on that, those who will still remember that would have Chester coming up to Marshal Dillon and saying, there's a gambling man in town, Mr. Dillon, and he's a real bad guy. And the marshal would say, well, how do you know that, Chester? And Chester would say, well, he's wearing a black hat and a black tie and a black suit, and he's got one of those evil-looking mustaches. You better get him, Mr. Dillon. And that would be it. And that's essentially what the argument now is for getting Saddam Hussein. He was a bad guy. Okay, everybody agrees. And it's frontier justice. The people in the Middle East are scared. Who knows where they're going to strike next? But the people in the Middle East also have one other very, very serious grievance, and that's the United States position on Israel, where they see the injustice done to the Palestinians as simply unforgivable, and that the United States siding unabashedly with Israel on every single key issue and providing them with military and other kinds of aid as an insult to an oppressed people. And I think the extent to which this is felt in the Arab world is really unknown. It was in Iraq when we were there. This is what every Iraqi would tell you. Mm-hmm. And it's what every Syrian tells you. There's 1.5 million Palestinians there that the Syrians have taken in, and I must say that they have equal shots at jobs and housing and so on. That the Syrians have probably treated them better than the other Arab countries have.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that those are legitimate complaints that the Arab countries have about the U.S. policy in the Middle East?
I think so. I think it's totally legitimate that there's no incentive for Israel to make any kind of just peace without having on that roadmap real justice for the Palestinians. I'm very dubious about this roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm reminded of, I'll tell you a little story. I imagine you have to go to a break, but there's a story that comes out of the Middle East, and it's about a tourist who sees a rabbi praying very frenetically against the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And the tourist pulls out the video camera and starts taking pictures. And the rabbi abruptly looks over, and the tourist apologizes and says, well, forgive me, Rabbi, but I never saw anybody pray so energetically. Could I ask what you were praying about. He says, all right, ask. I was praying that there should finally be a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Oh, my goodness, the tourist says, that's so noble. Do you think you were getting anywhere with those prayers? And the rabbi says, ah, it's like talking to the wall. And that, I think, is, you know, also expresses a sentiment that's felt very widely.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Saul Landau today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking a lot about the Middle East. Saul Landau just returned from Syria, where he's making a film. We're going to talk about Cuba, Latin American U.S. media in the second half of the show as well. The number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have lines open. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Saul Landau.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wondered and questioned about your encounter with the antique Jewish dealer in Syria. I heard a talk by a Syrian Jew, well, not very recently, maybe 5 years ago or so, and his experience living there was very different from the description that you said. He was very happy to get out of there, and apparently, I don't remember in detail the talk, but I remember one of the things he mentioned was in order for a Jew to move from one side of the city to another, they had to get permission, and there were all kinds of restrictions. So, you know, I was somewhat surprised when you talked about the encounter you had.
Yeah, well,
you know,
I was surprised.
This is a man
too.
Who actually lived there. So.
I was surprised, too. I had seen a 60 Minutes show that Mike Wallace did, I can't remember how many years ago, on the Syrian Jews. And he found similar results to mine. But
well,
I've also heard the other side, that the Syrian Jews were restricted and so on. And that might have been right, certainly at the point of the 73 war and right afterwards, when Syria and Israel were, well, they never did sign a truce, by the way.
But Saul, you, from your experience, your sense was that the gentleman you spoke to was not anomalous. He was, there was, you didn't hear of other stories that contradicted this guy's story?
No, I didn't, but I can't say in 8 days, Bob, that I'm an expert.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you spoke to one person.
That's it. So,
And I'm just saying, this is a person who lived there. So.
Well, this is a person who lives there.
I know, but...
And he returned from Brooklyn. He said he didn't like life in New York. It was too hectic,
but
too,
he was still
too materialistic, living. And he went wanted to go back.
Right.
I said, why don't you go to Israel?
Right.
He says, I don't want to go to Israel. This is my home.
Right.
I like it here.
But he was living in Syria, so, you know, it's possible that he felt some restraint about the kinds
of course it's possible.
I just wanted to mention this because this was my experience with listening to somebody who had lived there. So that's all.
Well,
sure.
I mean,
I claim no expertise. I was rather shocked by this encounter.
Right. So was I.
Well, thank you for calling.
Sure.
Well, Saul, let's turn, if we can, now to the Americas. Callers are welcome to call in and talk about the Middle East. But one of the areas that you're an expert on that you've covered for a long time and done documentaries on and written about is Cuba. And have you been to Cuba recently?
Well, I was there in late January.
That qualifies as recently in my book. You know, I think that I had a friend who just emailed me, he's an economist, an agricultural economist, and he went to Cuba for the first time this year. He studies all sorts of things dealing with agriculture. And he emailed me. He's not especially interested in politics. And he emailed me afterwards, not too long ago, and said, you know, he was just shocked when he got to Cuba because it was completely not what he expected based on the press coverage in this country. And I never got a chance, I haven't had a chance to get back to him and ask him what was different, because I'm just fascinated now by his comment. But I was wondering, this is a question I'd like to pose to you. What would someone find if they were to go to Cuba that might surprise them if their knowledge of Cuba was based largely on what they saw in U.S. news media?
Well, I think the first thing they would be surprised about is how freely everybody interacts and walks around, and the absence of armed people, the absence of patrols and controls. I mean, if you go to Mexico City, you see armed guards everywhere, not just police, but armed guards in front of every house, in front of cars, in stores, and so on. You don't see any of this in Cuba. You see people relating freely and in a very friendly fashion. I think this is one thing that shocks Americans, because they go and they find people who, you know, don't seem to be terribly oppressed by Fidel Castro, and who, by the way, don't think about Fidel Castro as the omnipresent force in their lives. Which is, I mean, if you listen to the propaganda in this country from the anti-Castro factions, they didn't want to send a little boy back to his father, right, Elian Gonzalez, because they would be sending him back to Fidel, as if Fidel was going to be his father. They don't want the embargo lifted because Fidel will get the money. They don't want the travel ban lifted because Fidel will benefit from this. It's as if only one person lives in Cuba, you know, if you listen.
Well, this Fidel doesn't play a role like Saddam Hussein used to play in Iraq, or some Maximum leader with his pictures on every wall.
No, you don't see the cult of personality. You don't see Fidel's picture. You see more Che Guevara, way more than you see Fidel. Or Camilo Cienfuegos, another early martyr in the revolution. You see his picture. You see Jose Marti's picture. But the Fidel pictures are infrequent. You'll find them in some people's homes, but he can't control that. But the cult of personality, which I saw in Iraq and which I just saw in Syria, by the way, which outdoes Iraq even. I mean, talk about the ubiquitous placement of Hafez Assad and Bashar Assad's photos, the father and son presidents. I mean, you can't find an empty wall space without it. This doesn't exist in Cuba. Unlike, I think, Saddam Hussein, who really did turn guns on the people, Castro's never done that. Castro had a legitimate revolution. He led a legitimate revolution. The goals were sovereignty, national independence, and social justice. And he went one step beyond that. I mean, he allowed Cubans to dance in the center of the world stage. I mean, what rinky-dink nation, and I'm using that term purposely and dramatically, that is a nation without gold reserves or major oil reserves or uranium, without a highly developed industry, has played such an amazing role in altering world history. Cubans changed the history of Southern Africa. They changed the history of this hemisphere. Cubans are famous all over the world as artists, actors, playwrights, film directors, musicians, certainly, athletes, scientists. What other small third world nation can claim such a starring role in the world today? That's what the revolution's done.
If
you look at it, Bob,
yeah,
from the point of what the revolution set out to accomplish and what it did accomplish, you would have to say it was, and notice the past tense, it was a success. Now, this doesn't mean there wasn't pain and there wasn't injustice attached to it, and families weren't divided and people didn't, you know, suffer needlessly for this, that, or the other reason. They did. There's been no accomplishment in history that's ever been painless. But the Cuban Revolution did pretty well, and it did especially well in picking the Soviet pocket. I mean, nobody knows how much money they ripped off from the Soviet Union. I say ripped off because I can't figure out what they gave in return. I mean, a little sugar at an extraordinarily inflated price. But then the Soviet Union collapsed. And that's where my past tense description would end.
You think that the loss of that Soviet subsidy really demolished the revolution? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it reduced it to mortal terms. Mm-hmm. Put it that way. Mm-hmm. Now Cuba's a third world country. That is, its standard of living is now much closer to, you know, much of the third world than it was before. Before, it was really much higher. They still have better medical care, they still have better education and social services, and the state still subsidizes, I don't know, maybe a quarter of everybody's daily monthly needs. But by and large, Cubans are now hustling in a way they never thought they'd have to do. They had 30 years of, you know, cradle-to-grave kind of servicing from the state. This wasn't lush stuff, this wasn't abundant, but this was basic stuff that was being given to everybody, and now they don't have it. Worse, Cuba, where's it going? I mean, my metaphor would be Cuba is like an airplane in a holding pattern, which is very slowly running out of fuel and has no clear place to land. Now, this doesn't make it any different than any other third world country. If you look at Mexico, where is it going? It banked its health on investment in maquilas, which are running away to China or shutting down because of the U.S. recession. Or look at Central America, which is, you know, the basket case of the world now, except for Costa Rica. Or Argentina. Or, you know, much of Asia and Africa, which are, you know, in terrible, terrible states. So most of the third world has no clear place to go. And the models that are held up by the IMF and the World Bank have clearly failed to materialize. That is, they haven't provided any elementary satisfaction for the majority of the population. Now, the Cubans are clinging, in a sense, to a day-by-day model. I don't know where they're going with it. And I think one has to attribute much of their staying power to Fidel Castro's, I don't know how you would call it, judo politics. I think that's probably what he's the foremost black belt in judo politics, able to use his enemy's strength against them. Because if you look at the number one source of revenue for the Cuban economy today, it's remittances, and they're coming in from the United States. So all the people who want to assassinate him and keep the embargo and punish him and so on are sending $300 every few months to their relatives. And that money ends up in the Central Bank of Cuba and is the largest single earner. So there Fidel does it again. I mean, first of all, he was, you know, able to export these people to the United States, where they've done some damage to us. Note the Florida election of 2000 as an example of how the anti-Castro Cubans played a role in helping George Bush get the presidency. I won't say win the presidency. So, I mean, if Machiavelli had thought of this, I think it would have been could be a marvelous chapter if someone wanted to do an update on the prince. How do you get rid of your enemies? Well, you convince your worst, most, you know, fearsome neighbor, the one who wants to destroy you, to take them. And that's what the United States did.
We're talking to Saul Landau today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Saul Landau, filmmaker, award-winning scholar, journalist, author, filmmaker. Talking now about Cuba and Latin America. We've been talking about the Middle East. He's just returned from Syria, where he's making a documentary. If you'd like to call in and ask Saul Landau a question, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with Saul Landau.
Hi. I want to bring up a few matters. First, I want to point out that you obviously have a very strong ideological bias in a certain direction, and it's, you know, appropriate, but it's yours. But so let's talk about how some of the issues. For instance, you talked about Syria and Israel. I mean, it's important to point out that Syria always has been at war with Israel since its very existence, has tried to destroy Israel, has fought with Israel a number of times. So the issue of the Palestinians now in 2003 really is just a new issue for the Syrians and for most of the Arab world, because it's only now that the Arab world is starting to say, well, maybe it's okay for Israel to exist, except, and then you get all the excepts. But for the longest time, the intent of Syria and the other Arab states and those who supported them, on the left particularly, was to destroy the state of Israel completely. So to now say that you can't have a real peace agreement or that the roadmap is inadequate is really the latest of a number of ploys of people who aren't willing to try to work out on some way to find a two-state solution that works between both parties. And I'll hear your response to that, but I just want to make one more point about Cuba and I'll leave off. For all that you say about Cuba, I think you've sort of left out the treatment of dissidents and various other groups, whether gays or others, by the Castro government, in the Castro prisons, and all the rest of that. Mm-hmm. That's easy to skip, but I think it's important to address.
Okay.
So I'll get off the phone and let you...
All right. Well, yeah, those are good points. Why don't you address those, Saul?
Yeah. I think I said that there are inadequacies in the roadmap. I didn't say we should scrap it. And I think that I don't want to scrap it. I do hope that a two-state solution emerges from this, and that now the younger Assad does make the peace treaty that the older Assad refused to make. I don't disagree with what the caller said in terms of Syria being at constant war with Israel, and up to a certain point wanting to get rid of it. I think that now everybody who is in a right mind accepts the existence of the State of Israel. I think, you know, what people didn't understand at the time, or many people didn't outside of the Arab world, was when you place a settler colony in any part of the world, but especially in one that has been so discombobulated as the Middle East, you're bound to have decades of turbulent politics and wars. And that, but, you know, Israel is. It exists. And anybody who challenges that is, in my opinion, not in the discussion. So I would just make that very clear. I just think the roadmap has to be a little bit broader and include those places from which tension will necessarily arise. And Syria is one of those places. On the second question, I was critical of Castro when he arrested and sentenced the dissidents to long terms, and I was critical when his police executed the people who hijacked the ferry boat. This was back in March. Well, the executions actually took place in April.
And there apparently was a big upswing in persecution of dissidents earlier this year in Cuba. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the term dissident should be understood very clearly. The people who were put on trial were people who took money, goods, and services from the United States government or from U.S. agencies. Now, this is important to understand because they weren't charged with essentially writing or organizing or doing this or that other thing. They were charged fundamentally with undermining the Cuban economy by cooperating with the Helms-Burton Law, which is designed to destroy Cuba. So that's what they were actually charged with. I don't personally think that most of these dissidents had anything relevant to say. The most relevant of them turned out to be secret police agents, that is, agents of Cuban state security. At their trials, 12 state security agents emerged with documents and recordings, which clearly established the guilt of these people in terms of what they were charged with. But what I'm saying is, if you have an organization so perfectly penetrated, where you surface only 12 of the state security agents, and by the way, these were some of the most articulate of the dissidents, the ones who made the most sense to me. If you have it so penetrated, why do you want to bust all these people and then put them away for a long period of time? First of all, it doesn't look good. You're going to lose trade, you're going to lose aid, and you're going to lose friends and influence. And that's exactly what happened. Secondly, you catch people hijacking, that's a very serious crime. I agree. I would say you could give people life in prison for that. They were endangering the lives of 50 passengers, and it was a very serious crime. But why do you have to whack them with lightning speed? And my only explanation is that I think the Cuban government went into a state of military crisis thinking as the United States went into Iraq, that they thought they could very well be next and that these dissidents would be the basis of a fifth column and or these hijackings could be the pretext on which the United States launches a war saying that this is a threat to U.S. national security. In fact, the U.S. government had said that. The Cubans can't control it. They better watch out. The Americans would consider this a threat to their security. So this is how the Cubans responded. I personally think it's a bad idea to execute people. I don't think if I disagree with the death penalty in the United States, it would hardly seem logical that I would support it in Cuba. I don't. and I think it was excessive. As I do think that the trial, that the sentences certainly to these people was also excessive. And, I'm not going to sign a petition denouncing Cuba because they did this, but I am going to criticize them, and I have done so in print.
Now, is there someone who's a...
on gays, I should address that very briefly.
Sure, please do.
I would say that the gays in Cuba are no worse off than they are in any other Latin American country, maybe even better off, and that the situation is far more complicated. And I'm sure the gays are worse off in Cuba than they are in the United States, certainly in some places in the United States. Like I just saw a program about that poor guy who was murdered in Wyoming. I think that the situation on sexual identity in a place like Cuba is a very precarious one. Cubans are, I think, have trouble with sexual identity. Otherwise, why persecute gays? In my own opinion, from what I've observed in my lifetime, the people who are most militant and most aggressive in coming after gays are, in my opinion, again, probably closet people themselves. And I would apply that explanation to Cuba as well. And my case rests right there. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, we've got a couple other callers, and I want to give them a chance to ask you questions. So let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Saul Landau.
Oh, yes. Hello. First of all, I'm very much enjoying the discussion. I wanted to ask a question about Cuba. In trying to predict what's going to happen next, I wonder if it's reasonable to think about Yugoslavia. I mean, in both cases, you had in Yugoslavia judo master Tito, who was able to hold the country together by magic, but he didn't really create any kind of serious infrastructure or a new charismatic leader to carry on. And it just, and I wonder if the same thing is going to happen to Cuba. Is there anybody who could take the lead after Fidel dies?
I don't think that they're comparable. I think Yugoslavia was a coalition of Croatians and Serbians and Bosnians and Muslims and Christians and Kosovians or whatever you call them if you're George Bush, Albanians and so on. And these people have different religions and they have different backgrounds and they speak different languages. And they had long histories not just of harmony under Tito, but of war and hatred. And Cuba is a totally homogenous society. Everybody speaks Spanish. Everybody shares a common history. That's one very important difference. Secondly, charismatic leaders can't be created. They're born. And I think Fidel is the master of consensus. When he passes away, I mean, people always say, what's going to happen when Fidel dies? I say it will be a big funeral. But aside from that, I think you're going to see committee government. I don't think you're going to have Cuba breaking down into separate entities as happened in Yugoslavia, or as could happen in Iraq if the United States can't glue it together in some way. So I don't think that's comparable. I do think that the Cubans have institutionalized, not necessarily past Raul Castro in terms of the presidency, but their institutions are quite adequate to govern their country. And I don't foresee a breakdown of civic order if Castro dies, as occurred in Yugoslavia. And I certainly don't see the compartmentalizing or the balkanizing of that country.
Have you gotten to know Castro at all over the years?
Well, I made 4 films with him.
Mm-hmm.
On one of them, I spent 1 week with him riding in the Jeep every day. So to that extent, I got to know him.
Well, what's he like?
Well, he's like a force of nature. I mean, when he enters the room, a wind comes in with him. He is charismatic, and I don't use that word as it's used in this country. Anybody who can make a good speech is called charismatic here. I'm using it in the original term. It means having godlike attributes. And that's what he has. He's above everybody else. This is a once-a-century kind of character whose own personal destiny and the destiny of the place he is born in seem to come together not only in his mind, but in the reality as history unfolds. So he's absolutely remarkable. Not that I agree with everything he says or does, as I think I've made clear, but he's a remarkably powerful individual. And everybody I know who's been with him has felt the same thing.
Okay, let's go to our final phone call. Paris, you're on the air with Saul Landau.
Hi. I have a question, something that's over the last couple of weeks has really started bothering me, and it's a media issue about the Nigerian papers and the potential purchase of uranium. That subject was actually brought up to the UN by Blix the same time that Powell, Blix brought it up to the UN the same time that Powell spoke to the UN. And it seems to me that that story appeared briefly in the media at that time, but it just kind of died and faded under the carpet. Blix actually questioned the credibility of those papers at that time. And I guess my question is, what do both of you feel is the media's responsibility towards not addressing the issue at the time? And that's my question.
Okay, Doug. Saul, right. I'll let you field that one. What do you make of this weapons of mass destruction stuff and the uranium connection?
Well, now the media
connection?
Finally is paying a little attention after, you know, the indications, as the caller said, were there from way back. I'm just reminded, I'll answer it with a little anecdote on Winston Churchill when he was about to announce a very unpopular policy. And one of his aides said, well, don't you think you'd better whip the press into line before you announce the policy? And Winston Churchill said, my dear boy, sheep don't need whipping. That's the only response. I mean, the American media have been completely irresponsible. They have repeated over and over again false charges. They have repeated over and over again false statements. Saddam Hussein kicked the weapons inspectors out of Iraq in 1998. This was said by every single leading media source. They didn't even bother checking their own archives. Had they done so, they would have found that in 1998, every one of them reported that the United Nations ordered those inspectors out. So that's just an example of the, I won't call it perfidy, I'll just call it irresponsibility of the American media. They have not played a healthy role in this debate. I mean, when George Bush said Iraq is a threat to U.S. security, the response should have been, go sleep it off.
You know, Saul Landau, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. I'd like to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been great having you. And I see you won an Emmy. Is that true?
For Paul Jacobson, The Nuclear Gang.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for being our guest. I'll be back in Media Matters in 167 hours. I want to thank my co-producers, Kumi Silva and Andrew Boyle, and Brett for handling the board today.
Okay.
See you next week.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.